Coming up next on The Exchange, we hear from three Siouxland state lawmakers at a recent legislative forum. There's talk about the Republican-led House and the Senate's almost complete control of the political process, and also the effect of outside interests.
We killed the collective bargaining law. That's worked for 40 years. We didn't really have a problem with it, but we killed it. It had to do with outside influence that is coming into our state, as they did Kansas, as they did Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin. Take your state, they're there, they're coming.
Also today, we look forward to spring. We'll talk about powwows and what they mean. That and more coming up on The Exchange. But first, this news. Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. The state legislature has been in session nearly 8 weeks, and a lot has happened. Lawmakers passed the controversial Chapter 20 measure that largely ended collective bargaining for public employees in Iowa, changed the way their health care will be managed, and might eventually affect their pension system. The Sioux City Council passed a measure this week that showed their support for the city's public workers. On Monday, the council voted to give unions representing the city a seat at the table when discussing benefits and the workplace environment, even though the new state law doesn't require them to do so. Council member Rhonda Capron said at the meeting that she was dismayed by the lack of consideration state lawmakers are giving to public employees.
It was pretty obvious what happened down at the state. You had all the Republicans voting one way, and you had the Democrats voting the right way, the way I see it. It really does upset me. This is why we did the resolution. We back our people.
Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott said the current legislature was not being respectful to local governments.
This is not only, for me, telling us how we're going to do labor agreements, but this legislature, and I've said it before, and I'm not bashful to say it, is the most anti-local government legislature I've ever seen. They cringe when we show up at the Capitol, and yet with most jobs are created in the cities that are affected the most by this. And that's pretty discouraging to me.
The criticism of the legislature's actions were top of mind a few days before the council meeting at a legislative forum Saturday morning at the Sioux City Public Library. The forum is one of several sponsored this year by the Sioux City chapter of the Iowa League of Women Voters. The room was packed with more than 200 mostly Democratic constituents. Republican Jim Carlin and Democrats Chris Hall and Tim Cassina took part, but Republican State Senator Rick Bertrand was not there, and his absence was noted. The Chapter 20 collective bargaining bill and the partisan manner in which it was swiftly debated and passed was the issue that concerned most of the attendees. Chris Hall said that traditionally the Iowa legislature and governor have worked together in the best interest of Iowans, and that's not happening today.
Right now what you have is huge, powerful corporate interests like Americans for Prosperity that have gone state to state and taken the floor out from good working people. You know, it affects your retirement security, it affects your security for your health care and what you're able to provide for your families, and it degrades the value of work itself. When you aren't working for a living and when you're not providing for your families in the way that you hope to, you're losing. You are not any longer working for yourselves, you're not working for the next generation or to improve the life of somebody else. You're working only to receive what's given to you, and that's unfair.
Republican Jim Carlin voted for Chapter 20. He said the real effects of the collective bargaining changes won't be known until the new public employee contracts are drawn up.
When the contracts are negotiated, when the ink is dry in that first contract, we're going to have a much better handle on the real impact of this legislation on you guys. And when that first post-contract is negotiated, I really would appreciate your contacting me and bringing to my attention those aspects of your new contracts which are problematic for you. Because I mean, you're my constituents and I represent your interests as well. And I want you to know that.
Several questions were brought up about the Republican bill to set one minimum wage for the state that would preempt some of the higher minimum wages that have been approved in four Iowa counties. Chris Hall favors a fairly substantial raise in the minimum wage, saying that most people who are earning a minimum wage are already in financial trouble.
I think that when we're talking about minimum wage, the most important starting point for that conversation is that anybody earning a minimum wage is living in poverty. And poverty is something that is not Democrat or Republican. Poverty is a hardship of life that few of us understand. And those that are experiencing it need better than just a minimum wage. There is within that legislation some things that would preempt local civil rights code and wouldn't allow local governments to, either in housing policy or in hiring policy in other areas, make sure that there are civil protections given to many Iowans, including LGBT Iowans. And that is a strong reason that I'm opposed to it.
Jim Carlin said he would like to see a raise that would be commensurate with the Consumer Price Index, or CPI. He said that different levels of minimum wages would cause people to move across the state to places like Des Moines or Cedar Rapids for better pay. Here's his opinion and Tim Cassina's response.
I would be in favor of a statewide increase in minimum wage that shows how much the cost of living has gone up. And, you know, the thing is I believe that you need to deal with realities. And one of the realities is we're not competitive with our neighbors, and that is a reality that affects our tax base and our ability to grow economically as a state.
Can I just say one thing on that? As far as Sioux City to West Des Moines, if you're living in poverty, you are not moving to West Des Moines, okay? You are trapped in poverty.
The Stand Your Ground bill generated a lot of conversation as well. Sometimes called the line in the sand or no duty to retreat law, it's a justification in a criminal case whereby defendants can stand their ground and use force without retreating to protect and defend themselves or others. One woman pointed to her son, who was in a hoodie with headphones in, and said that he was an example of the kind of teenagers who could be shot if that bill became law.
And someone with a gun could see my son as a threat and scream at him, and he's not listening because he has his earbuds in. That legislation is dangerous.
Time's up.
I'm sorry, but it's dangerous. I'm gonna share my information with you. The empirical example is Missouri. Thank you. I wanna know if background checks can stay, and I wanna know if Stand Your Ground will go away.
Jim Carlin said he supported the bill and believed that background checks would stay in place. Cassina and Hall opposed Stand Your Ground. Hall said he's heard a lot of evidence from law enforcement officers that it can be dangerous.
But one of the primary reasons that I vote against Stand Your Ground and don't believe that it's smart public policy is because when you talk to law enforcement officials and you talk to police officers who are out on the street and they're trying to resolve disputes at a bar or a public setting, the thing that makes their job worse and more dangerous is when you give everybody in that situation a gun.
There were a lot of questions and comments about the Republicans' bid to defund Planned Parenthood, even though no state funding actually goes to pay for abortions. One constituent asked Jim Carlin how he could still oppose the organization and its mission to help underserved women with health care, including young girls who had been victims of rape. Carlin replied that Planned Parenthood should be defunded because it denies the value of a human being at the beginning of life.
Once you get down the road of deciding who is and who is not a human being because the manner in which they were conceived, I think you've lost your way. And, you know, that's anytime we go down the road of defining what is and what is not a human being, I think you lose your way. If we let our humanity to be defined by 8 to 10 weeks in a womb, in a mother's womb, and at the same time, you know, you would tell me it's wrong to be racist. It's wrong to judge a man by the color of his skin. And I would agree with you. I think that's wrong.
Both Cassina and Hall opposed defunding Planned Parenthood. Cassina said that defunding it would make it much harder for women to access health care and birth control.
There are already no tax dollars used for abortions in this state, okay? We know that. Lots of reason. When we have 97% of what they do is directly related to women's health services. I can't do that. Best way to reduce abortions is through education and through contraception, very simply. If we reduce unwanted pregnancies, we reduce abortions. Just that simple.
One area where Republican lawmakers would like to put some money is voter integrity. They support Secretary of State Paul Pate's effort to set up a mandatory voter ID system that would use computers to verify signatures. That project could cost up to $1 million. It would also create more hurdles when citizens register to vote. Hall and Cassina said there have been about 10 examples of voter fraud in the whole state of Iowa during the last election, and they opposed the bill for that and other reasons. Carlin supports it. Hall and Cassina also say that outside influence and money are partly behind the voter ID bill and a larger far-right agenda this year in Iowa.
We killed the collective bargaining law. That's worked for 40 years. We didn't really have a problem with it, but we killed it, or basically rewrote it, took it away. It really didn't have a lot to do with what we are doing here. It had to do with outside influence that is coming into our state, as they did Kansas, as they did, you know, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin. Take your state, they're there, they're coming, and they are in Iowa right now, and they're doing very well.
That was Tim Cassina, a Democratic state representative from Sioux City, at Saturday's legislative forum at the Sioux City Public Museum. He was joined by Democrat Chris Hall and Republican Jim Carlin. The forum was sponsored by the Sioux City chapter of the Iowa League of Women Voters. Another forum is set for March 25th. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The issue of outside funding and political power is also of concern to State Treasurer Michael Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald sent out a news release Friday afternoon warning state employees that the Iowa Public Employee Retirement System, or IPERS, could be in danger of being weakened by Governor Branstad and Republican lawmakers. Fitzgerald says he's watched as the state has decimated the collective bargaining system for state employees, and now he fears they'll turn their attention to IPERS.
So what else can you take away from public workers, teachers, you name it, is their pension fund, IPERS. And the governor and the lieutenant governor have publicly made statements that they want to really look at IPERS and change it. And there's a Republican senator, Brad Zahn, who's entered a bill to take IPERS away from being a defined benefit plan and just to turn it over to the private corporations to run in what we call a defined contribution plan. So those are my concerns.
How much of a difference will it make if we go from defined benefit to defined contribution?
It'll make a huge difference. Right today, public employees put in 6% of their wages, and the state puts in 8.9% of the wages into a fund, and they can count on a guaranteed retirement pension. If they work 30 years, they will have a pension of about 60% of their final five-year average. It's a good pension. It's worked for years. Now, what the Republicans want to do, because IPERS is such a huge pile of money, turn it over to privatize it, turn it over to Wall Street firms to manage. And they charge 2, 3% or more to do that, taking basically half the earnings from the investments people are putting away for retirement. But that's what the state wants to do, reward Wall Street at the expense of our teachers and other public employees. And these 401k style systems, they just don't have the success of producing a good benefit. The records show it.
So what is this about? It sounds like when you listen to the governor and some Republicans and the House and in the Senate, that this is about a inability to keep up with funding this IPERS pension fund, that as they look down the road, there just won't be the money. Do you think that's the case?
Well, in some states, that is the case because they've overspent, mismanaged, whatnot. But just like Chicago has 700 million or 700 murders a year, Des Moines or Iowa, we don't have that kind of operation, or that isn't the way we live out here in Iowa. And it's the same with the way we manage our money. Our budgets are balanced. We have reserve funds. And our pensions are sound. IPERS is 84% funded. The judges are 87% funded. And in the pension world, That's solid. It's good as gold.
So we've had prudent investing in the fund, prudent payouts, you believe. Why, again, are we doing this?
We're doing this because really the Koch brothers and Iowans for tax relief, they're the major corporations. They don't want us to pay public employees. And that, you know, pensions is part of the pay, like insurance is part of the pay. And if you keep hurting public workers, yes, corporations may have to pay a little less, but it's hurting our state. And these are outside corporations, outside the state of Iowa, are pouring millions of dollars into our political system to get their way.
So what can the average citizen do about this if they're concerned?
The average citizen, that's why I'm putting out the message. I think when the Iowa legislators actually hear from teachers and people that work in the courthouse or city hall or in the water districts or if they're prison guards or whatever, if they hear from these people that they're outraged, that how they're demeaning them, lowering their pay, hurting their future, and if you're retired, they say, oh, we won't touch it. There's cases out there where people are trying to cut those pension funds. That will hurt Iowans. But if you call your legislator, call your governor, and I would encourage a lot of people, send a letter to the editor. Make your voice heard, and that can change a lot.
A lot of voters and people who work for the state tried that when they brought up the collective bargaining bill, and it didn't seem to make any difference. It was a very party line vote.
It was a very party line vote. That's correct. And it's happened in other states. It's happened in Wisconsin. And they seem to have gotten by with it without much political damage. But in Kansas, they've done it as well, and they've really hurt the education system in Kansas. The state's been downgraded financially, and that's going to start costing them business, and it's going to cost them tax dollars. It's also hurting them in Louisiana, where they did these things to strip public workers of benefits and pay. And Louisiana now, besides having their credit rating dropped, the cost now in the last 4 years to go to LSU, their state university, the tuitions went up 60%. Those are the kinds of things that will happen unless it's derailed.
That was Iowa State Treasurer Michael Fitzgerald talking about the need to protect the Iowa public employees' retirement system from being diminished by legislation sponsored by Republicans. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate is proposing some changes in the state's voting rules. The changes would require every Iowa voter to present a government-issued ID that would be verified by a computer system. There would also be changes to the voter registration process that would make it harder to vote. John Wills is a Republican representative from Spirit Lake in Dickinson County. Will says he wouldn't call the bill voter ID, he would call it voter modernization that would require a voter ID card that would be verified by a computer in all 99 counties in Iowa.
And that computer with a scanner can scan the barcode on your driver's license or government issued ID, or a ID will be mailed to all voters. So all registered voters would get a voter ID. And that can also be scanned. I kind of look at it as kind of like the Hy-Vee checkout stand or the Hy-Vee express lane, where voters can go through fairly quickly and vote. There's no standing around in lines and that sort of thing. So that's kind of what we're looking at, is kind of bringing our voting system up to more of a modern era.
So how much will this cost?
Well, right now the estimate is about $1 million, but that's probably going to come down significantly. We'd probably look at less than $500,000 is actually what the cost will be when we get it fully shaked out and looked at.
So will every county need to have their own version of this equipment for this to work?
Yeah, that's the major cost. Basically, what we plan on doing is setting up a loan system. The Secretary of State's office would set up a loan system that counties could borrow money from and then pay that money back. So if they don't, right now 73 counties have this system already fully implemented or in part. And so what this loan system would do would be to help the counties to buy these computerized scanners, and then they can pay that back to the state, basically interest-free. And so that's kind of the major cost part of it.
Well, some of the county auditors have gotten together and have said that they were told before the election that there was nothing wrong with the voting system and there was very little fraud. So they were saying they wanted more proof as to why they needed to do this.
As far as fraud, that's kind of one of those things that nobody knows because there's no mandatory reporting. And so I do know of, I believe, 10 cases of fraud just in Story County that have been identified. But, you know, we don't know if that's a widespread thing or not. One part of this law or one part of this bill is to make any attempted fraudulent access to voting to be a mandatory reporting item to the Secretary of State.
This kind of a change in the voting law has been challenged in other states. Indiana, a lot of lawsuits there. I believe that case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And a lot of people question whether or not it's constitutional to say to people, well, you have to have a certain kind of ID to vote.
I believe the challenges that have succeeded have been if you have a picture ID. If we require people to have a picture ID, that could be construed as using skin color or whatever as a way to get people not to vote. The way that we're looking at and proposing is not any kind of thing like that. It's not discriminatory. It doesn't provide an undue burden to anyone. In fact, it makes it easier to vote. And so there's no real reason to even challenge something like this. This is something that would be very, in fact, it'd make our system easier and better.
Well, I believe a lot of the Democrats say that it would create one more step for people who might be low income, might not have the correct ID to begin with, and that would be somewhat unfair to them. And of course, most of those people are in the Democratic Party, so they're saying this is possibly politically driven.
Yeah, well, you know, there's 80,000 people in the state of Iowa that supposedly don't have an ID of one form or another. And so that's the 80,000 people that we're looking at, 80,000 out of 3 million. And so we cannot absolutely not hinder or harm their ability to be able to vote. And we don't intend to. And that's why they would receive a free voter ID card. You just have to be able to prove that you're a resident of that county in order to be able to register. That's with anything. You have to prove that you're a resident of that county. And of course, that's why is that a bad thing?
That was Republican legislator John Wills of Spirit Lake. He was talking about the voter ID bill that will soon be debated by the legislature. It calls for every voter to have a government-issued ID that would have to be verified by a computer in every one of Iowa's 99 counties. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. This is the first day of March. Soon, it will be spring. And that's the time when the tribes of the Midwest begin holding their traditional powwows. The powwow developed from many different Native American traditions and became popular with white audiences more than 150 years ago. Grant Arndt is an associate professor of anthropology and American Indian Studies at Iowa State University. He spent many years researching the origins and traditions of the powwow to write his new book, Ho-Chunk Powwows and the Politics of Tradition. Arndt says the powwows he writes about have a Siouxland connection.
It's relevant to Sioux City because the Ho-Chunk powwows in Wisconsin started as a result of the community being gifted the powwow tradition that started in Nebraska on the Winnebago Reservation there, because that's their Ho-Chunk as well, right? These are two halves of the same original nation. And so that's the older powwow, and that's one of the oldest powwows in, I guess, one of the oldest powwows, I was going to say in the world, but, you know, North America is the world for powwows. So that's been going on since, I'd have to look up in what I say in the book, but since I think 130 years or so, a long time. And that came to Wisconsin as a gift in 1902 or around about 1902. And it has deep cultural roots, and I try to talk about those in the book in terms of times to honor warriors traditionally. And it comes out of kind of cultural activities that circulated among Native communities in the 19th century as life changed and as people had to deal with, you know, settlers coming in and the traditional way of life changing, developing cultural practices that kept alive and kept honoring warriors, but in a slightly different form. So that the powwow is based on these kind of warrior honoring ceremonies. But then when it comes to Wisconsin, it's a more public kind of culture, or it's a different kind of culture. It has sacred elements, but it wasn't a sacred gift. So people could use it in different ways. And so the community very early in the 20th century, as I talk about in the book, started having it be more of a public event. It was a time to gather. And actually by that time, there were lots of like races and other things that were held in association with the dances honoring warriors. And so it became more of a public event. And very early on, this is what I found fascinating, the community began to invite local residents, local non-Indian residents, whites, to attend. And the Ho-Chunk people have been involved in cultural performance, tourist performance, Wild West shows for a couple decades at that point.
In the book, you describe a time back in the 1820s when some of the tribe actually went to the White House. And I was wondering why they were there and what happened.
This is really famous. There had been a conflict in part of the Ho-Chunk territory, the lead mining region in what's now kind of southwestern Wisconsin and northwestern Illinois, Rock River area. So there was a conflict, and there needed to be a peace accord made. Unfortunately, usually these peace accords were made to pressure Native people to cede their land. So they were there to negotiate over kind of, you know, the conflict, and meet with the president. It was also, as I say in the book, it was very clear, and people in newspapers at the time were talking about this. They were saying it was also to sort of impress them with how powerful the United States was. So they'd feel pressured to sign a peace treaty, right? They would realize, oh, here's a big, they took them on a tour of Philadelphia and New York and Washington, D.C., really just to try to wow them with how powerful the United States was to get them to cede it. It didn't work, right? Or it didn't actually cow them. People would admit it. I mean, the leaders were very savvy, but they were also very realistic. And so eventually a peace treaty was made, and that's the first treaty ceding part of the Ho-Chunk homeland to the United States. So they're there. Yeah, they're there. I mean, this is a time when they're foreign dignitaries, right? They're foreign leaders who are coming to the White House to meet with the president and talk about, you know, foreign relations. It's funny because it's America. It's not just the United States. So it's North America, but you know, the United States is a foreign country, and they're foreign leaders and politicians. And so, yeah, so they're there. And what's interesting, and I talk about in the book, because they put on a war dance on the lawn of the White House, and people are very interested in Washington, D.C. And You know, so this is it, and it's a display of, I mean, they use it to send a message about their own power and their own history, right, to people in Washington, D.C. watching it. So, yeah, I found that interesting. It's the first kind of, again, it's one of those performances where it's meaningful. It has a deep tradition. It's actually related to diplomatic ceremonies that are found throughout the Midwest. I talk about Calumet ceremonialism, we say now, peace treaties, peace ceremonies. But it's also public performance, right? So it's both.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it's that long history. And then I end that chapter with them coming to Chicago for the World's Fair as performers in a Wild West, or in a kind of the context of a Wild West show.
It seems like in the last 20 years or so, there's been a lot more emphasis put on the cultural roots of Native Americans and the tribes,
yeah,
and creating a sort of this cultural space for them. How does this, the whole powwow tradition, fit into that in the modern world?
Well, I think there has been this, and a lot of it's tied into economic development. There are more resources, and part of those resources can be invested. You know, if you have a economic system for your, you know, that and a budget, then you can put some of that towards cultural activities. And powwow has been one of those in many nations, right? Many tribes have powwows, and that leads to a lot of I think cultural enrichment, because as I try to talk about in the book, you both have in powwows, you have kind of this contest aspect of powwows. It's competitive. There are dancers who go from powwow to powwow, and there can be really high prize money for champion dancers. And so, you know, they get really good, and there's a real, it's a really intense competition. And you have people who are, you know, singers, singing groups, drums, who also go and are on the circuit. And so, you know, you get this real enrichment of culture through exchange and competition. It, you know, it becomes kind of a job for people. They can really, you know, devote themselves to developing their dancing and singing in this tradition that has these deep roots. And they're innovative, you know, there are parts of it are very oriented to tradition, parts of it are very innovative as well. So I think that, yeah, it's been really this part of having resources and having resource and things like powwows. You know, I think they come and go in terms of how important people think they are, or different people have different opinions. You know, it's a very attractive, beautiful, meaningful kind of culture. So I think that brings people in who are interested in it as a culture, and appreciate it as, you know, a beautiful forms of art. So, you know, that have these deeper cultural roots. We have this funny, you know, like art versus culture and different kinds of culture. And I always think of, I say this in the book, but this is kind of general. Culture is really the way we talk now about spaces or frameworks in which, you know, sort of our values matter, whoever we are, right? We can talk about what really matters. We may have to get jobs, or, you know, we have to survive, but we can talk in the space of culture about what really matters. And so I think that powwow is that, can be that, right? Some people will say, no, it's not. You know, there's traditional actual culture is somewhere else, and we should protect that boundary, and it's private, but it can serve that important function.
Is it something that the tribe is doing that is kind of a way to talk about their culture and something that's good for them? Or is it something that basically the outside white people, other people are using and commodifying? And there seems to be sort of between the two a kind of a tension.
Yeah. We want that to be a clear division, right? We'd like to look back and say it's clear. But I one of the things I think is, if you look back, there's not anything that makes monetary gifts like not culturally or not appropriate, right? I mean, and so you can have it both ways. It is honoring important ideas and values, and continues to honor important ideas and value to the present, right? But it's also about, you know, I say in the book, like, you invite people in that, you know, then they're kind of exposed to your values. They can appreciate, you know, the culture. And if you're dealing with prejudice and racism outside, I mean, have them come in. It's beautiful culture and music. And so people get to see that, and they get to see there's a lot of emphasis on generosity and patriotism. So it has, you know, it's kind of good in both ways. So in that, before it becomes something that, you know, is controlled by other people.
Grant Arndt is an associate professor of anthropology and American Indian Studies at Iowa State University. He published his first book, Ho-Chunk Powwows and the Politics of Tradition, in 2016. Dwight Howe is a Native American speaker and activist. Howe was raised in the Ponca tribe and is a member of the Omaha tribe. Howe says the powwow comes in many forms and can help to bridge the gap between cultures.
The new year for the Plains Indians here in this region is spring, not January 1. Dominant society celebrates January 1 as the new year. But here, culturally, for generations, when that first thunder comes here, when that first thunder, we hear that, we know the thunder beings are here and Mother Earth is going to wake up. She's been sleeping. And now all her medicines are going to grow. And everything's going to be growing. And we celebrate life. And we have Hedoshka dance for that. We have a Mipahunga. We celebrate the spring, the coming of new life. And then pretty soon, animals are born. And pretty soon, it's a growing thing. It's a beautiful, every year. Right now, this is the month of the Omaha that they call the month when the geese come home. And you can hear them flying around and all over. And when I see that, and I think, how long ago was it that we called it the month when the geese come home? That we could have been calling that for 500 years. I mean, so there's a connection that ties me to my ancestors, because that's what we call it, the month when they come home, and there they are coming home. And so there's a time warp type thing that sort of happened with me. Older you get, the more sentimental, and you see things differently. And there's more gratitude that I have. And so I'm looking forward to seeing the Omaha's dance, the spring dance of the Hedoshka, to celebrate life. And if I can, if I'm able, then I'm going to get dressed and I'm going to dance out there and support that.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. I would love to take my daughter to something like that. She would enjoy it.
People ask that all the time when they say, well, you're having the Winnebago powwow. It is a huge powwow in July. I think it's in the last week in July, I think. But it's huge. I mean, it's well attended. People from all over come to there. And I have guests that come to St. Augustine's from Denver or from Sacramento or from other places, or even just as close as Creighton, who's coming next week to do service work. And they'll ask me, can we go to those things? And I'm saying, well, right there at the gate it says $5, so if you got $5, you can go, you know. Only people with $5 can go to that dance. And so if you got $5, then you can go in there. And sometimes they let veterans in free, and other dances it's free. It's open to the public.
There's not a one-size-fits-all, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
It makes
sense. So there's different, and so there's different types of dancing. There's your contest powwow, big money. There's your college powwow, which is money but educational. And then there's for celebration and for interacting. We're going to do something at Briarcliff, I think, next month.
Oh, really?
Multicultural thing.
Oh, okay.
Where different ethnic groups are coming, and we're going to put a little dance troupe together.
Oh, that'll be great.
And they're going to have like little corn soup and fry bread and feed the people and talk about Indians. There are competition powwows, and there are celebration powwows. I used to be a cultural advisor for the powwow committee at Cal State Long Beach. And the majority of the people that were there were non-Indian. But still, we did that for the students who were Indian. We asked outside drums to come. There was contest money, so people came to dance, to compete. But the majority of the people were kind of oblivious to the breadth and scope of what this thing was all about. And I think, in a way, that can be a tool to gain understanding of each other. In a way, it's an opportunity. Then there's ceremonial dances that are old, ancient. The Omahas have been dancing here on this area from almost down to Missouri all the way up to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, this whole area here for almost 500 years. And it's what makes it particularly important to our youth is that those songs that the Omaha sing, they're not just, hey, ya, hey, ya, hey, ya, hey, ya. They are actual stories. They're stories of family members. They're stories of tradition. They're stories of values. There's lessons in them. And if you can learn those songs and learn the language, then you get a deeper relationship to that song and to that ceremony and to that dance. And a lot of them are war dance songs that talk about veterans, or they talk about God. A lot of them, a good many portion of them, are prayers. They're petitions to Wakanda, God. They're asking for courage. They're asking for help. I stand here, you know, have pity on me. And we dance to those things. There are other songs that are stories. I've been dancing. I'm not an entertainer. I'm a traditional dancer. It's called Heloshka.
That was Dwight Howe. Dwight is a Native American speaker and activist. Howe was raised in the Ponca tribe, and he's also a member of the Omaha tribe. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. After several starts and stops over the past decade, the Sioux City Arts Center plans to break ground on a new 11,400-square-foot companion structure this summer. The Gilchrist Learning Center is the first of a two-part expansion and renovation plan. Siouxland Public Media's Allie Carson has more.
This month marks the 20th anniversary of the opening of the Sioux City Art Center's 45,000-square-foot facility on Nebraska Street. While the Art Center has existed as an organization since 1914, it took bold, innovative thinking to build the $9.2 million facility that would bring iconic artworks to the community, feature the talents of local artists, and educate future generations of art aficionados all in one place. And now, it's expanding. I'm here today with Director Al Harris-Fernandez to talk about the Gilchrist Learning Center. So adding on to the Sioux City Art Center has been a goal since 2004, when the Art Center Association, the nonprofit fundraising arm, bought the now demolished bus transfer building, formerly located along Pierce Street. So why has it taken so long to see this project go from concept to completion?
Well, the first thing is after we bought the property, then the public museum decided they were going to build a new museum downtown. They requested us not to compete with their fundraising and put our project off until they'd completed theirs. And I believe they didn't open theirs until, 2012? So that postponed it, and then also the recession in 2008 made it more difficult. Made them take a longer time to do their part. But anyway, now we're ready. We started a new campaign, and we're just about there. We have a $400,000 goal between now and June the 1st, and then we'll be able to break ground this year and open next year.
Why was this identified as something that the Art Center needed?
It has several reasons for coming to fruition. One is to increase accessibility to the education component of the Art Center. The way the building was constructed now is we'd have to have extra security there if we were going to have classes every night and if we were going to do after-school classes. By creating another standalone building, we can be open for education all day long and not have to worry about the collections and other issues in the permanent Art Center facility. That's one reason. Another is that we wanted to remodel or repurpose parts of the Art Center to increase space for the permanent collection and to create a better storage space and a larger, more secure storage space than we presently have. So those are the two phases. One is build a learning center. Two is repurpose and remodel the current Art Center to increase our position in the region as a major exhibition space, continuing our temporary blockbuster exhibitions while at the same time increasing space for the permanent collection.
And by doing this, I mean, it's the learning center. You know, you're obviously expanding educational opportunities.
Right, and we've got a collaboration, a new collaboration with the public school district, the community school districts. We're going to do a lot more programming with them. And then we're also going to be able to offer afternoon classes for families that are looking for those opportunities and evening classes every night of the week based on public demand rather than the security of the art center and its permit collection, et cetera.
It's an interesting time for the Sioux City Art Center to expand, considering that there's talk of eliminating federal funding for the National Endowment for the Arts, which Lyndon B. Johnson established in 1965. You know, this issue comes up again and again, whether or not federal funds should go to art. But before the NEA, there was the Depression-era Works Progress Administration, and the Sioux City Art Center has its roots in that. You know, it was part of a WPA project.
That's true.
You know, that's what gave the organization its first permanent exhibition space in the basement of the Willigis Building in 1938.
But, you know, that didn't last very long. And while it helped get the Art Center started, the city then stepped in 42 and said they liked what the Art Center did, and they provided funding. As a matter of fact, you know, that grant from the federal government was actually most of it returned because there was such an outpouring of private support and volunteer support that the Art Center was able to actually return some of those funds. That's an interesting part about this, kind of the community-based Art Center. And, you know, currently we don't get very much funding from the National Endowment for the Arts. So they're a very small part of our budget.
Okay.
But I do support the idea that they are probably significant supporters of some organizations that really do need their support.
On the right, you know, they'll say, you know, it's not necessary spending. And then on the left, you know, one of the arguments is that accepting grant money like this, government money, you know, impinges on the creative freedom of the artists. So it's a
two-edged sword in a lot of ways. I mean, I know there's some organizations that don't request any money from the NEA because they're not interested in jumping through the hoops that that organization requires. We have occasionally apply for NEA funding. We occasionally get an independent individual grant for NEA funding. And then we get Iowa Arts Council funding, which part of that is NEA funds. And we appreciate that. You know, it's a good thing. I wouldn't turn it down. But we're not dependent on that funding to exist. We have huge community support by those people that live here that support the Art Center, that think it's important. And the city council thinks it's important, and they support it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see the NEA go away, but it's not significant funding for our program.
Yeah. So that leads into my next question of, you know, the John Henry sculpture, which is sometimes called the French Fries. That was commissioned using funds from Iowa Beef Processors and the NEA.
That's true. That's a good example of a nice piece of art in the community. I think it's a wonderful piece that was significantly funded by the NEA along with a private business that stepped forward. You know, if we didn't have art museums, we wouldn't have access to paintings because they would be rare, because it's only, you know, only a certain amount of people can really afford to buy a lot of art and put it in their homes. Most people can't. So the idea of having a space where the art is brought together and made accessible to everybody for no cost is a wonderful, wonderful thing to have in our community.
That kind of speaks to the last question I had here was, you know, what does art add to a community? You know, what is its value, if you can even place a value on it?
You know, I'll just say something. When people travel, they go to another city. Where do they go? They go to the museums. They go to, you know, it's usually arts related, whether it's a convention center with a rock and roll group. It's all arts related. They go to the parts of town that are aesthetically interesting and beautiful and challenging, you know, and exciting. Those are the arts. And so I think as far as the cultural destination, you know, anybody's been to Chicago and gone to the what I call the Jelly Bean or the pond deal that they have there, those are amazing. There's like communities form around those areas of town. And so I think that's very important. I also think that the creativity is based on the idea of experimenting, reflection and analyzation, then experimenting some more. You keep doing that with kind of a loosely defined goal, and you discover things along the way. And that's the creative mind. And it's not just artists that are creative. There's scientists. There's all sorts of people that have that inclination. I think it's good to allow kids to understand that creative process. And maybe that'll cross over into other areas of their life, too.
That's Sioux City Arts Center Director Al Harris-Fernandez. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Allie Carson.
That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Be sure to join us next week when we'll check in on what's going on with several pieces of legislation in Iowa, South Dakota, and Nebraska that might affect us here in Siouxland. Also, a new horror novel set in central Iowa. We'll talk to the author, and we'll talk about some challenges facing the LGBT community in Sioux City and beyond. Join us next Wednesday at noon for The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. Thanks today to Mark Munger, Allie Carson, Steve Smith, and Rick Turner. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks for listening.